All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Hello and welcome once again to the Read Rothbard podcast. This is the very first podcast that we are doing from the planet Hoth, the ice planet Hoth. How are you doing, Robert?
Chilly. We just had a temperature contest, and I dominated you. It's only 19 degrees over here right now, where it's a balmy 29 over where you're at.
Man, got my shorts on, sun's out, guns out. It's great.
Shit, yeah, dude.
Yeah, so it's pretty dang cold, especially in my Reed Rothbard HQ, which is a shipping container box.
Yeah, how do you live in that thing these days? You have a little heater, right? A little space heater?
Oh, yeah, I've got two little heaters going. I've got blow-in insulation. I've got parka on. I've got an old lady crocheted knit style blanket over my lap. Good stuff.
Nice. Appreciate that image.
Well, you know how I do.
Old Mother D.
So today we're going to talk about the movie Django Unchained. More like...
But before we do...
Freedom Unchained, maybe. Something like that.
Yeah. There's a fair amount of freedom going on in that movie.
But before we do, let's talk about one of our pseudo sponsors. Not really a sponsor, but we push this guy's stuff a lot. It's Tom Wood, Liberty Classroom. If you missed out on the Friday, Black Friday deal, you missed out on the best pricing of the year. However, the master membership that Tom offers, he is taking 150 smackers off the price now through December 30. So you can still get a really great deal at Liberty Classroom. So go to readrothbard.com/libertyclassroom and click on through. Save your dollars, and we'll still throw in for the next four a readit4.me annual membership valued at $299. So get on it, fools, get on it. And now back to our regularly scheduled program. Take it away, Robert.
Yeah, that guy's a legend, Tom Woods. Nice dude. So before we get into the old Django, I was telling Daniel about this YouTuber dude. Baring, who's this Australian dude, and he pretty much takes the piss out of social justice warriors and feminists, and just as I was starting to talk, Daniel just flips on the record button like a boss, signaling he wanted me to talk about this. So, like 2 days ago, his channel got taken down by apparently some guy with like a vendetta against him. I don't know the history of that vendetta. Maybe he was just one of the guys that got attacked by Baring, criticized by Baring, don't know, or he took offense at something Baring said, which is fine. Baring says lots of probably offensive things. They're also very funny things. But his channel got taken down, and apparently it's because of the artwork he uses for his bear in his videos is almost identical to this cartoon bear on this TV show, Total Drama Island. So, what do you think about that, Daniel? Do you think this is a legitimate taking down? Do you think this is a legitimate copyright claim? Talking about, do you think he's profiting off of somebody else's work? I would say that the content of his channel is not about the fact that he's a bear at all. I mean, he makes a few jokes about being a bear. But the artwork does add a little bit to the professionalism of the videos, but he could have been anything. He could just have a picture of flower and whatever, and people would still probably check it out. But what you know about intellectual property and trademarks and copyrights, Daniel, what do you think about this?
Well, I'm going to differ from Murray Rothbard a little bit on this and say if it doesn't violate the NAP, then what's the big deal? Like, a copyright has a certain level of contractual obligation between two parties involved. But once something's out in the world, especially in the internet, you know, once this fair drawing is out there,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of fair game at that point, you know? I mean, it would be a bit fraudulent if he were to go around claiming he was the creator of the bear and saying that the bear show was his show. But he's not doing that. He's just using a similar, if not the same, drawing for an unrelated thing.
Right. So, yeah, the drawing is his content is completely unrelated to the Total Drama Island thing. And as far as I know, the Total Drama Island people aren't the ones that have a problem with him. Now, if they did, what do you think about that, though? What if the Total Drama Island people came after Baring and said, look, you're using this image of our bear for this guy that says anti-SJW stuff, and our bear in our cartoon isn't like that at all. We think you're damaging our brand. Do you think they have some sort of a claim?
You know, part of me wants to say yes, but where's the violation of the NAP? Where's the force of the fraud?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, maybe this is a gray area. And Stephen Kinsella, I forget how you say his name. I think it's Stephen Kinsella. He's a big-time libertarian attorney, intellectual property type guy. He's got a book called Against Intellectual Monopoly. I believe that's what it's called. And I have the book. I just haven't read it yet. I got to get on that. Maybe I'll have something more intelligent to say. But my gut reaction is, if you were to take some well-known character and then make it do something obscene or distasteful, like let's say you take Mickey Mouse and make him do, you know, sexual positions with one of these bears from Total Drama Island. And I'm sure people do that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm sure if you were to look up Disney porn, you'd find plenty on the internet. What it's there for, the internet.
That's right. And you're right. Those things exist, from what I understand.
Says the expert.
That's right. I can definitively say that kind of pornography totally exists.
So does Disney have any standing to say, hey, that doesn't accurately represent our mouse? Even beyond the arbitrary, 70 years of copyright or whatever that gets perpetually renewed. I mean, we're getting in the weeds here, and I really don't have a good answer other than stick to the principles. You know, once something's out in the world, it's kind of like the rap game. You know, you take that beat and you take some Hennessy and pour it on top and mix it up.
Well, can we take anything from the fact that there are these laws against it? And I don't know if this is like a common law thing or if this is more of a government law thing. But there have been lawsuits where, you know, you are damaging our brand by being almost identical. Like there are all kinds of like Starbucks ripoff type things where you just change the logos a little bit and you call it like Harbucks or you call it whatever. Now, I know when it falls under parody, that's fine. But when, I don't know, I don't really have a good example. But I know that there have been court cases successfully won in the past that are over copyright claims. And it happens all the time where you have to make sure that your new business isn't, you know, different enough in name and in appearance and in whatever to something that already exists, or else they will come after you for damaging their brand or whatever, causing market confusion or whatever they want to call it. Same way that they go after knockoffs, which I know as anarcho-capitalists, we don't have problems with those things. They're filling market needs. But do the original makers not suffer some sort of detriment? Like if you make this high-end Gucci bag or whatever and made out of the finest materials, and then there's also these knockoff bags that are really crappy, and someone buys a fake Gucci bag but they think it's a real one and then it falls apart, do they think worse of the original brand? Are they less likely to buy the original brand? All seems like kind of gray area.
Yeah, you know, the one example you gave with of the bag where the person thought it was a genuine one, just at a better price.
Right.
I mean, in essence, it's buyer beware, you know, like make sure you're buying what you think you're buying to the best of your ability. And when you make a mistake, you know, you suffer the consequences, the immediate consequences. Like you made the decision to not go to the Gucci store and pay the Gucci price. You chose to go online or in some warehouse, you know, downtown, to pay the not Gucci price.
So from Gucci standpoint, though, you don't think they have an argument?
I don't think that customer would have bought their bag at the price that Gucci wanted. I mean, maybe some would. I don't know, but it's not as if is the brand, is the identity a tangible good, and can it be stolen from someone?
Well, what about, what is the argument, if there's anyone at all, to be made? Say that Starbucks has spent all this time and money establishing their brand, and they're known worldwide for a certain level of quality and whatever.
Or lack of.
Or lack of. And then somebody else starts a business, and they call themselves Starbucks, but they put like a little umlaut or whatever, you know, slight variation. And then they get to capitalize on that, the decades of brand awareness. And otherwise, their coffee wouldn't have done nearly as well, but all of a sudden they're getting just as much sales as like any other Starbucks-like outlet.
Well, in today's world, I'm sure there's all sorts of legal and other means that they can use against them for doing that. But are we talking about in Capistan?
Yeah, in Capistan.
Man. I still don't see a violation. Like, no physical thing was taken. It's incumbent upon the consumer to make sure that they're getting the product that they think will best satisfy their preferences, their desires.
Does it? Do you think it falls under fraud in any way? Because it does create a more informed consumer. One thing all these protections and EPAs and FDAs, all they do is really make a really lazy consumer. And one argument against Ancapistan is that companies would just exploit whatever to do whatever, and we'd just be at the mercy of all these companies when all of their behaviors and practices are all market forces. And to the extent that people care about their practices is to the extent that they would use their products. But yeah, it would create a more informed consumer, like you're saying. But is it in any way kind of fraud by purporting yourself to be a legitimate Starbucks?
Yeah, I'd say assuming the identity of another person is a form of fraud, similar with a company or another entity, you're basically claiming that this is a legitimate article. But I don't know if the... I mean, it is fraud, but who is the fraud perpetrated against? Is it against the rightful, you know, is it against Starbucks or is it against the consumer trying to make a purchase?
It kind of seems like it'd be up against both. I mean, at the same time, you're not actually directly competing against a Starbucks. Like, you're in a whole new location. You're selling, you know, different coffee, your own coffee. But you are capitalizing on their, all the time and money that they've spent establishing their brand.
Yeah, but that's all sunk cost. I mean, they were going to do that anyway, right?
Yes. For sure.
Yeah, this is a tough one. I mean, I think if you're representing that you are selling a genuine thing and yet that you're not, then you are committing a fraud. And so, you know, if found out, there should be consequences to that action. Perhaps they get blacklisted, called out for selling, you know, improper... the identified stuff. I mean, I'm sure that the market would solve for this.
Right. I have no doubt about that. It's just whether or not it's a violation of the NAP or not. Are you actually committing fraud? Because if you're dealing with you're only committing a fraud to someone who's not paying attention, right? Because you can't exactly do the exact thing. Otherwise, you're no different than like a chain store, like a franchisee. But if you're just slightly different, that just creates a more demanding consumer, right? Because you're not actually coming out and saying, hey, we're Starbucks. We're Starbucks, whatever.
Oh, okay, so you're saying if it's just similar but not actually claiming to be the same, like there is some difference. I don't know.
Yeah,
man,
what if you go into this Starbucks and all your employees pronounce the word Starbucks just slightly differently and the logo's just slightly different? And all their uniforms are slightly different. A different shade of green or whatever, their smock.
Wasn't this what people who are making fake Rolexes, you know, Folexes, would do, is change the R in Rolex to like a P or something so that they weren't technically violating something?
I don't know, but that sounds like a thing.
Like maybe they're trying to get around, like, well, we're not actually a Rolex, we're Polex. I think that's Chris Rock joke.
Okay.
But, you know, you're not going to buy a Rolex for $20 off some guy wearing a trench coat with a bunch of watches underneath, you know?
Right.
And I think that is on the consumer to be aware of that. And I would think that most consumers who are buying a Polex are doing it just because it sort of resembles a Rolex if you don't look super close. I mean, it's like a costume jewelry kind of thing. Like, Maybe they're trying to, what do they say, represent?
Yeah.
Be flashy with without spending the money?
Right. Yeah, you're filling a market need, but are you aggressing against Rolex in any way?
Well, you're sort of competing with them on a scale, different scale.
I mean, the competition isn't aggression.
No, competition is not aggression. I mean, part of me also wants to say that if you take a very successful and well-known brand and you piggyback on that and you make your logo and your name similar, but not the same, you know,
mm-hmm.
but enough so that someone will see it and they'll their interest will be piqued by it or whatever. I mean, that could be a smart marketing move, you know?
Oh, it absolutely is. That goes to show all the, I mean, all you can just, that's a testament to how much of a market knockoffs is.
I have heard a story, and I don't know if it's legitimate, but that one counterfeiter of handbags was so good that when the company that makes the high-end ones that cost, you know, $1,000, $5,000, I don't know what the numbers are, finally caught up to them and found them, they're like, you know, you counterfeiters, you're making a bag better than us, so we want you to start making our bags for us.
That's funny. Well,
I mean, there's something to be said for a brand commanding a higher price for the same quality of a good in some respect. Like, in that example, if it's true, we're going to assume that bag manufacturer, counterfeiter one, was making them for a lower price than the high-end manufacturer was
able to, yeah.
Yeah, was absorbing. Mm-hmm. And so they found a higher quality bag at a lower price, and, you know, consumers will buy it because they want that brand name, so they'll spend premium for it. And it's not, you know, because it's a higher-end bag in quality terms, it's because of the name, like, or whatever preferences the consumer had.
You know, sure, they might want the prestige or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, there's a million reasons why if people buy something, they choose this thing over that thing. And
mm-hmm.
it's all individual preferences. But people are willing to pay more for certain things that lend, you know, to prestige or bling or why the guy buys the Polex, you know, to look flashy even though he doesn't want to spend $10,000 on a watch.
So, getting back to Baring, do we think that he has a chance? Because he's on YouTube, and YouTube has a very strict copyright claim type notice policy, where they are a private company. They're their own platform. They can have whatever rules they want. But apparently they have some sort of a three strikes and you're out rule, where if you have to get three different copyright claims against your channel before they shut you down. And I don't know what the resolution process is like to getting your channel back up or what have you. I'm sure he's free to start up a new channel. But, I'm not sure. But I assume that's true. So from that point, that's all well and good. They can have whatever rules they want. But apparently his three different claims were all about the same thing or something like that. Or like he had three different claims, but they were all about, I don't know if they were all about the bear issue, probably. But he probably figured that it was like one claim, so that he would be fine. But obviously not. Anyway, do you have anything else to say about that, Daniel?
Well, I think it would be a simple matter of him just changing his image to something that isn't copyrighted.
And that's what Anarchy Ball had to do, right? Apparently Anarchy Ball is copyrighted by somebody else, so he changed himself to Mr. Dapperton. But he kind of kept, or I guess it was the art that was mostly the copyrighted?
I think it was the name.
Because I kind of heard it was the art. But
well, he changed to Mr. Dapperton.
Right.
Of the channel.
But he also
everything.
Changed the artwork.
Yeah.
And he's replaced all his old artwork. Keeps re-uploading old videos with new artwork.
Yeah, you know, at the time when he was going through that, I commented, like, fuck him, you know, like, copyright shouldn't exist. And do what
yeah.
you want. But, I mean, there are consequences to choices you make. And so I think for him, or them, or they, or Jay, I don't know, that they should, do whatever is going to make it easier for them to still continue to get their message out and entertain people.
Right.
And Baring should do the same.
Right. Yeah, I think he was, what he was doing is so lucrative. I can't imagine him not coming back, just changing something. Because he's not, I mean, he's got a decent name, Baring, but, I mean, who cares? People will find him under whatever name it is, doing whatever.
Well, the name isn't the problem, right?
Right, it's just the image, as far as I know.
Unless he has changed the name of the bear in that show, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I don't know if now that his channel is dead that he can restart, you know, a new channel under the same name. I don't think he can. But I don't know. Again, I don't know. So anyway, that's about all I have to say about that. I don't know if I... it's unfortunate. He's if you don't follow him or if you didn't follow him, and of course you can't now, but maybe he will be able to in the future, he has some of the most consistently funny stuff that I've found on YouTube, and he puts out a ton of content, or at least he did. Pretty much like a video, two videos, three videos every 2 days or so. Really strong stuff. But you get thrown in, I guess, with like the alt-right. Anytime you attack the left at all, you get thrown into this alt-right like label. So he's been labeled with that, and I don't think it makes a whole lot of sense. He makes a few political statements here and there, like he's a fan of democracy for some reason, but he mostly just makes fun of stupid things feminists and SHW say, so whatever that makes you. I don't know.
Yeah, that's, I don't know. I think if people are going to hassle you, then figure out how you're going to respond so that you can continue to do what you're going to do. Find a way to overcome it.
Yeah, dude.
Is it important for him to have that particular bear, or is it more important for him to create the content and get his message out there and make them dollars?
Probably more to make them dollars, because that was his full-time job. He actually quit a job in high finance to do YouTube videos. And apparently, he's doing quite well. So, I'm sure he'll get back at it. Unless he's just sitting on a pile of cash from already doing it for a while. Anyway, let's move on to the next topic, Daniel.
Yeah, let's move on to the next topic. That would be Django, the D is Silent, Unchained.
Yeah, so I saw this movie. When did this movie come out? Like 2013? Quite a while ago? 2012?
Still seems new to me, baby.
Yeah, it's new to you because you just saw it for the first time. But, yeah, we growing up, we were big fans of Tarantino. I still am. I think you might still be. I don't know. But it kind of surprised me that you hadn't seen this movie, even though I know you live in a world of cartoon baby things and songs about the Beatles and fluffy things with stuff. You can't really watch too much Tarantino stuff right now.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And also, I don't know, I was a big fan of Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. And a lot of people wet their pants over Kill Bill, and I was like, okay.
Yeah, no. And then you just kind of forgot about him?
Well, I still know who the guy is.
You know who the guy is, but you haven't seen any of his latest work, from what I understand. I mean, have you seen Hateful Eight?
No, I did see Inglourious Basterds. And Jackie Brown was terrible.
Well, Jackie Brown was a long time ago. That was like 20 years ago.
And Get Shorty's not him, right?
Correct.
That's also terrible.
Yeah, I don't know who did Get Shorty, but it wasn't him.
That was like the next Travolta movie after Pulp Fiction, I think.
Yeah, probably, something like that. I know he was in Get Shorty.
Yeah, I just want to mention one thing, Robert.
Hmm.
You're old, man. You're a fucking white male.
I know. It's true. So everything I say is wrong. I can't possibly have anything valid to say. I know.
Yeah. Folks listening, I'm just making fun of a white male who is bitching at another white male in an SJW video by calling him a white male. Right, it's just weird.
Yeah. They don't follow any kind of logic. So Django, starring Christoph Waltz and Jamie Foxx, and Sam Jackson, and Leonardo DiCaprio, who we're not the biggest fans of, but I think he does a good job in this movie, playing the villain. What was this movie about, Daniel?
Well, this is usually your wheelhouse, but basically it's just shy of 3 hours, and the story can be summed up as this dude Django is a slave, and he's been sold off, and his wife has been separated from him, and this Christoph Waltz guy is a bounty hunter, And he seeks out Django because Django knows how to identify some of the people that he's after. So he goes and finds him and frees him, or tries to purchase him from the slave traders who have him. And then he takes up Django's plight for losing his wife and wanting to get her back. So he becomes partners with him. And through the winter, they bounty hunt, and then he agrees to go help him get his wife back. And that's essentially the whole plot right there, right?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And his wife is at Candyland with DiCaprio, in which they pose as Mandingo fighter trader guys looking to buy a fighter from Candy, when they're actually there to free Django's wife. So were there any scenes in this movie, Daniel, which seemed like interesting Reed Rothbard podcast type scenes where we, you know, break down a thing that happens and whether or not there's a violation of the NAP or not? I have a few ideas, but I know I didn't watch it recently. It kind of sprung this on me. I want to say that in the very beginning of the movie where Django is in like a slave, he's like walking along with a bunch of other slaves and they're all chained together and they're being led by these two slave trader guys. And then I don't remember exactly how it goes down. What I know, the two slave trader guys end up dying. Christoph Waltz shoots one of them, is that right? Or both of them?
He shoots one of them, but in arguably self-defense.
Oh, it is? Okay. So what happens?
Well, he offers to buy Django, and the guy doesn't want to entertain his offer and points his gun at him and threatens to kill him.
Because he doesn't want to sell a slave?
I think there's a little bit more nuance to that situation, but he was going to kill him, and so he fired first. And then
the slaver fired at Christoph Waltz first?
No, but he had pointed his gun at him and was threatening to kill him.
Okay, so that's perfectly justifiable.
Yeah, and then he shoots the horse of the other guy, causing the horse to collapse on him and break his leg. And then when he frees the remaining slaves, he says, well, you guys can pick up this guy and bring him to the nearest hospital or town, you know, 27 miles that way. Or you can do whatever you want with the guy and then just leave.
Now, what if, Daniel, let me turn this a little bit. I would argue that slave trading is not a valid occupation. I would say that the slave trade occupation in and of itself is a violation of the NAP. What if Christoph Waltz comes across these slavers and their slaves and just guns down the two slavers straight away? Doesn't say a word, just guns them straight down. Is he coming to the defense of these people that have been kidnapped by these guys? I would say yes.
So you just want an all-out free-for-all for anyone who's violating the NAP against someone else?
I don't know what you mean by that.
Well, if you're saying that you can just gun down anyone who's participating in slavery, what if we look at slavery as, you know, in the custom of the time, it was an acceptable thing for whatever reason, and it's not too different than everyone right now being inured with believing in authority and that taxation is necessary and important, and if you don't pay your taxes, you're somehow defrauding or cheating or stealing from people. I'm trying to draw a parallel between how different are we from the slave days from a perspective of absolute freedom, and where do you draw that line when you're talking about coming to the defense of others when there's this full-blown cultural acceptance of something?
Well,
that makes sense in what you're saying?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying, but I don't think that changes the principle. Whether or not it's socially or culturally accepted doesn't change the fact whether it's right or wrong.
Right, but you're arguing for murdering people.
I'm arguing for somebody coming to the defense of another.
So would you take that same argument with somebody who has money being extracted from them by the government in present-day times?
Sure.
Interesting.
I'm not saying that I'm justifying whether him just gunning down people. I'm saying, is he coming to the defense of another? And I would say, yes, he is coming to the defense of another. I'm saying he's murdering somebody. He's violating the NAP. But he is coming to the defense of another. Is he or is he not? I think it's clear that he's yes. He is coming to the defense of another. I think he's making the judgment, an aggressive, violently aggressive judgment on how he's doing that. When, you know, probably he should have gone up to these people and said, you need to let these people go. You've kidnapped them against their will. And when they don't, then, you know, seek to, I don't know, negotiate with them or, hell, but I think he would be justified in using force to free them. Because they've already initiated the violence, Daniel. The slave traders have already initiated the force. Dealing self-defensive force is justifiable.
I want to say yes, and I want to say no, because...
Are you saying in just this situation, or are you saying in general?
I'm saying in general. And
In general, self-defensive force is not moral? Or moral, or kind of moral? What do you think?
Well, I mean... For legal definitions of self-defense, it needs to be an immediate and imminent threat to your body or person or that of another that you're coming to the aid of.
Well, what greater threat is there than taking someone's time?
Right, but then just put it to present day, 30 to 40% of your time is stolen from you.
Right, absolutely.
And the chains are still on you, my friend.
Absolutely, 100% agree with you.
So
the only reason that...
a moral... righteousness in defending yourself or others, but in all practical terms, it's not a good idea because you'll end up dead very, very soon.
The fact that it goes against the cultural social norms is only a practical argument. It
right.
has nothing to do with morality. And that's only because the only reason you wouldn't do it is because, well, these people are all insane and they will kill me.
Right. It's like, what's the character's name in those cartoons, like Mongo or something? He's a, you know, retarded.
The Bugs Bunny cartoons?
Yeah, it might be Bugs Bunny.
Are you talking about Mongo in Blazing Saddles?
Well, it could be. I'm talking about a generalization of a character who is dim-witted but affectionate and doesn't realize that their affection is causing significant harm or killing something.
So you're talking about, what's his name in A Vice and Men, where he's petting the bunnies and he's killing the bunnies by petting them?
Yeah. So I liken the people who supported slavery as kind of being like that, or the people who support statism as kind of, you know, in present-day terms, as kind of being like that. Like in The Matrix, they say, you know, anyone who's in The Matrix, what is it? Since they don't know that they're in The Matrix and they can become violent and confronted, they can be your enemy. Like, anyone in there can be your enemy.
Uh-huh.
And it's because they don't know any different.
Okay, so then you're saying that, okay, what are you saying? Are you saying that the slave owners, the slave traders, were not aggressing against them, or they were, but it's okay because they didn't know any better?
This is tough.
But this is what we do on the Reed Rothbard podcast. We answer the tough questions. Well, we try to. We don't actually usually come up with an answer.
All right, so let's take it to the guy smashing the bunnies. Right, and then let's change out bunnies for, like, humans.
Uh-huh.
He doesn't intend them harm, but he is doing harm to them, and so you would have every reason to attempt to stop him. But you can't say that he's doing something immoral if he doesn't understand that what he's doing is wrong. You know what I mean?
No, I don't know what you mean. Are you saying that the slavers didn't know what they were doing is wrong, therefore you can't say that they were doing something wrong?
Let's go back to the retarded guy.
Let's go back to the rapist who's like, no, she wanted it. It's fine. Okay, let's go. He's smashing bunnies.
Smashing the bunnies and change them out for, like, babies, you know?
But, sure, yeah, like the Green Mile or whatever, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you obviously have to stop him.
Yeah.
I guess you need to be aware of...
So you're using force.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, yeah.
Okay,
I mean,
so you are going to attack a slave trader.
You keep bunnies and your kids away from him.
Yeah, you keep the black people away from the slave traders. Gotcha. But they're not going to give him up willingly. You have to take him by force. You have to free them by force.
In the film, he only wants the one, and he wants it done legally, so he wants paperwork that's signed off. And the other ones that get released are just a byproduct of his, you know, of his seeking out Django.
Right, he offered to buy they'll won. And the guy reacted violently to that.
Right.
So are you going to use force against the slave traders to free the kidnapped black people? Yes or no?
Well, I mean, how it plays out in the movie, he's defending himself from being threatened to being shot.
Right. But if he hadn't, if he just goes up and sees somebody being kidnapped by another person for no other reason that they have dark color pigmentation on their skin, do you use force to free those people? Yes or no?
I think it's up to the individual and the circumstances.
Right. I'm asking you, Daniel.
Well, I'm not a fan of Good Samaritan laws.
I'm not asking if there's
no
a
positive
law for it or against it. I know you have no positive obligation. I'm asking, what would you do? You're coming to the defense of another or you're not?
Well, since I don't come to the defense of others in everyday theft by government,
right.
And because that's a cultural norm, I think that I would probably do something similar back, you know, 150 years ago.
You just wave at the guys and be like, be on your way, Mary, sir.
Well, I mean, isn't that what you would do? You're doing it today.
Fellow businessman. You're right. I'm not like some superhero out there defending against people, aggressing against other people all the time. You're right. And I'm heavily outgunned. But I'm saying, if he did that, would he be morally justified in doing it or not? That's the question. Are you justified? Are you morally justified using the force to liberate the slaves from the slave traders? Or are you saying that the slave traders don't know any better, therefore they're not actually doing anything immoral, and therefore you don't have the right to violently aggress against them to free the people that they're violently aggressing against?
There's a lot of nuance in here. And a lot of it's circumstantial, you know, and pragmatic.
Well, I'm asking a moral question, not a pragmatic question.
Well, sure, the morality is that they're doing wrong by having slaves and selling humans.
Yes. Regardless of whether they realize it or not.
Sure, they're still smashing the bunnies.
Yeah.
Whether somebody does something about that and whatever those consequences are going to be, I don't know. I mean, that's a situational.
No, that's not the question. The question is whether you're morally justified in using force to liberate these people.
Then yeah, you are.
All right, we got an answer out of him.
As you can see, there's a lot in
there. I did it.
There's a lot in there, you know.
I mean, sure, there are all kinds of implications.
You'd be morally justified right now, but you'd get killed really quickly if
True.
You were to try to step, you know, in preventing police officers from doing something that they shouldn't do, or tax collectors, or any of those things.
Absolutely. But not because I'm not morally justified in doing it, but because I face a huge immoral force against me to stop me to doing that.
Right. You're outpowered. You're overpowered significantly by a wide margin.
Yes. I'm outnumbered and outgunned. But not I'm not in the wrong.
But
so that was the first scene that I thought of. Okay, go ahead.
Well, like, those people, you know, doing their police work or policing. I don't want to call it work or a job.
Policeifying.
But people out doing that, and they don't know any better. They think they're into it because they thought it was a good thing, and they think they're a good person. They think they're doing good.
Absolutely, that is the brainwashing, 100%. They think they're making the world a better place, getting the bad guys, and sometimes they do that. Like 5% of the time, they actually do that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's tough, man. In Capistan, sometimes seems like it'd be just so much easier.
Yeah, it would be. All right, so that's the first scene that we're going to talk about in a 3-hour-long movie. What's the next scene? Or what's the scene that jumped out at you that's interesting to talk about? I mean, I think coming off the top of my head, there's the, as they go into Candyland, they're purporting themselves as fighters. I want to talk about that. I also want to talk about, you know, if that's fraud or not. I also want to talk about Wanted Dead or Alive, the job of bounty hunting, whether that's morally justifiable or not.
Okay, let's do that first one, and leading into it, and just say that third one. Say your third one, and then I'll try to remember it.
Okay, and then there's also the KKK ambush, whether was that really self-defense or not. Let's do the KKK one first, because that's earlier on in the movie, isn't it?
Well, that's after they go to Big Daddy.
Big Daddy? Who's Big Daddy? I don't remember that.
Don Johnson? It's the first place that they go, and they find the three men that went. What's his name?
Oh, right. And they just shoot him on sight, right?
Yeah. There's a bounty on them, dead or alive. And so they go to Big Daddy's ranch. They're working there under a different name. and yeah. they shoot them, and then Big Daddy raids in return with the KKK guys. Or I don't know if it's KKK, it's some precursor, right?
Right, well, they're all dressed up in hoods and whatever.
Yeah, so you remember who Big Daddy is. He's the leader of that group.
Right, and Jonah Hill's there, and they're all complaining about whether there's eye holes or whatever. It's
yeah, you can't see a fucking thing. And well, you know, if my wife didn't have to make 35 of these fucking things, no, she'd be unappreciated. There's some pretty good dialogue there, just bitching and annoying.
Yeah. So, but that scene is, Christoph Waltz and Django, they go to that plantation, and they have a wanted dead or alive bounties on these three guys, and they just shoot them all dead. And as a retribution for that, like, kind of violation, Don Johnson gathers up a posse of KKK guys, and they're going to go and they're going to murder in revenge Christoph Waltz and Jamie Foxx, but of course they've set up a trap. They got like a decoy thing, and they're sitting on a hillside some distance away, and then they're going to start sniping at them. So,
yeah. So what's the question?
What's all the implication of that? So first, let's just do whether or not Christoph Waltz and Jamie Foxx have the moral right to shoot at these KKK members as they are destroying their property. Because that's basically all it is. They've set up some bedrolls, like decoy stuff, and it's basically a trap. So are they morally justified in shooting at these KKK guys who are essentially just shooting at their wagon? Is that right?
Well, let's back it up a bit, because didn't they go to Big Daddy's place under false pretenses as well, like present themselves as something other than they are?
Absolutely.
But it's also part of their bounty hunter shtick, right? Like they do whatever means gets them closer to their target.
Right. And you're dealing with violent people. So, okay, well, you want to talk about the whole, whether they're doing anything fraudulent or not first?
Well, they are misrepresenting who they are. I mean, they can't just go there and say, well, we're here to, you know, murder three dudes.
What they could do is show up and say, hey, we're bounty hunters, and we've got these bounties for these three people, and we believe they're in your employ.
Right, but they didn't know they were there. I mean, they were going from ranch to ranch or plantation to plantation, like trying to find out. So,
right.
You know, Django would go and talk to the people and, hey, you ever heard of these guys? And they go, oh, yeah, he's right over there working in that field.
Right. So are you saying that they're committing fraud?
In a way, yeah. Yeah, I think they are.
So when they pose as Mandingo fighter trader guys, they're also committing fraud against Mr. Candy?
Well, they're certainly not being truthful.
Well, they're not being truthful, but do they have a moral obligation to be truthful with someone who they understand is also not being truthful or being violent?
Was lying a fraud? I mean, people lie every day.
People do lie every day. When you're dealing with a violent situation, are you under some sort of moral obligation to tell the truth? I don't think you are.
Well, I think there is an objective morality, whether you choose to follow it or not, is an individual choice. And they were certainly trying to employ certain means to achieve their ends, and telling the truth versus lying was lower on their preference scale.
Okay, but from my point of view, you're dealing with somebody who is established that they are not a moral person, that they will use violence to get what they want. So in that sense, I don't think you're under any kind of obligation to be truthful with that person.
Well, when they approach Big Daddy, I mean, he didn't threaten them.
But he's constantly threatening all the people around him.
But that happens every day, all day long, even today.
Yeah, but not to your average person that you talk to, you know, in your friendship and your whatever circles. Not everybody you know owns slaves and will whip them and beat them and murder them if they choose to. Are you saying that you're under some sort of moral obligation to tell the truth at all times when a cop pulls you over because you were doing 55 and a 54?
I think it's an individual choice whether you want to tell them whatever you want to tell them.
But are you under some sort of would you be moral in lying to them?
Well, is the act of lying immoral?
In a vacuum.
For whatever reason, then yeah, they'd be immoral, but it doesn't really matter in that on that level of morality, you know. It's a matter of degree, certainly, right?
Well, but you're being threatened. You're being violently threatened by somebody. What obligation do you have to treat that person with any kind of respect? If someone comes up to you and sticks a gun in your face and asks what your name is, and you say your name is Humongous, how can that person be super upset that you didn't tell the truth in that situation? For all you know, that person is trying to get information about who you are, where you live, what kind of valuables you have, what are the names of your family members that they could find and kill or whatever. You don't know anything. All you know is that you're dealing with a violent person who is threatening you with murder. I don't think you're under any obligation to treat that person with any kind of respect, any kind of moral code. You do what you can to get out of that situation and get away from that person and to tell that person nothing. They've already established themselves as a piece of shit.
It's up to the individual to determine what they're going to do. I think self-preservation is probably the key thing there. I mean, when they approach Big Daddy's place, you know, they're saying what they need to say to gain access to the grounds, to be able to find out if the guys are there.
So is this an argument for the ends justify the means?
In this instance, it kind of is, yeah.
Okay.
Well, like you're saying, do they have to be truthful to someone who's a thug?
I don't think you do, right? I think absolutely not.
Lying is immoral, but the ends do justify the means in that instance.
In that instance, I don't think you're under any obligation to be moral at all. You're under no moral obligation to act in a certain way when dealing with someone who has violated the NAP and is constantly violating it.
Yeah.
Did you have more to say before we get on to that KKK situation, or do you want to move on?
Let's see. So they get on to Big Daddy's property, and then find out the guys are there.
Right.
Kill the guys, because there's a bounty.
Yeah, Jimmy Fox just shoots them down, right? He just shoots them dead.
Dead or alive, and that's the arrangement, you know, and that's a bit questionable as well. But.
Well, because this is a bounty offered by the government, right?
Right.
Dead or alive.
So it's easier to kill them from a distance and then try to take them alive, you know?
Right, and drag their bodies in.
Yeah, so there's an incentive there to do the
kill.
Dead part.
Right, because it's a lot more difficult to bring them in alive. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. It is a request by government or a bounty offered by government, so, you know, not exactly.
Now, do you think that in Ancapistan, that a bounty wanted dead or alive is a moral thing?
It could be.
Really? Any more said about that?
Well, I mean, let's say you got a serial killer running around in Ancapistan.
Alleged serial killer.
It's Ancapistan.
Alleged.
And you know who it is, or you have enough evidence to satisfy that you want to, you know, seek justice.
Okay.
I mean, it's almost Hatfield and McCoy, McCoys. But I think that I can foresee instances where somebody has done truly horrible and despicable things and will be a threat to others to do those similar things or even escalate them.
Right. But you would be going out and killing that person when it isn't an imminent threat.
Right, but they've already done something.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know exactly how justice would be served in that, you know, Ancapistan-type situation.
Sure, but we can contemplate on the morality of a thing, can't we? That's what we do here. Is it morally justifiable to put out a bounty on somebody, wanted dead or alive, for an alleged crime that somebody committed?
Let's say I see some guy kill my kid and he gets away.
Yeah.
I know it's him. Am I justified in getting a bounty or seeking him out myself?
Indeed. Are you?
I think so.
Because you think you are. That's fine that you do. Would you be violating the NAP by then going out and aggressing against him
No.
Yes, no.
I think he's transgressed beyond reproach, and the situation is not over until both sides of the transaction are closed.
Okay. What if
he
you're wrong?
The bargain.
What if you get the wrong guy? What if you put out a bounty and somebody else, the wrong person, comes back dead?
Well, I think you would argue that the person who sought the bounty was responsible for their individual actions.
Sorry, what?
That you would argue that it was just bad advice, or even if the advice was good and they chose, you know, incorrectly.
Well, they just made a mistake. Like in Game of Thrones, I don't know if you're familiar. You probably haven't watched as much as I have. But after Tyrion is accused of murdering the king, he escapes. And in response, Cersei puts out a bounty, and he's like a dwarf, you know, so whatever. She puts out a bounty on all, like, male dwarfs. She's just like, find this Tyrion guy. She doesn't necessarily say all dwarves, but she says, you know, she describes who he is. You know, there's no, like, photographic evidence in medieval whatever. So she goes, well, he's a dwarf, and he's got a scar on his face or whatever. Bring me back, you know, his head. So what happens is, you got all these bounty hunters, they bring in all these dead dwarf heads. You go, is this him? No. Is this him? No. Is this him? No. Meanwhile, there's all these dead dwarves getting murdered trying to service this bounty. There's got to be some sort of violation of the app in that situation.
Sure. Yeah, lots of innocent people are getting killed.
Yeah.
But is she responsible for that, or are the individuals who've decided to go and murder a bunch of dwarves and cut their heads off responsible for that?
Well, I think ultimately, there's the people who are cutting the dead dwarves' heads off, of course.
But they wouldn't be doing it without her impetus.
Right, the incentive lies with her. She's offering some bounty, and she is providing, you know, not perfect information, apparently, about his identity or what exactly he looks like or whatever. But, in the show, he didn't even kill her son, the king. So he's just mistaken about the actual murderer. So is she violating the NAP there? Or is she, you know, the whole thing is terrible because she's wrong about who it is and the wrong people get murdered in response.
Yeah. Now, in the show, is she wrong, obviously wrong, or does she think she's right?
She is sure that she's right. It's a secret who actually killed him. Spoiler alert, it was Littlefinger and Lady Olenna.
Damn it, Robert. I haven't seen it.
You don't even know those names, and you're going to forget that I said this by the time you actually ever get around to watching it. But anyway, you can all hate on me. It's fine. Send your email, robert@readrothbard.com. So those two people did it, and they did it in secret, obviously, and they kind of framed Okay, I'll explain the situation. For any Game of Thrones, whatever, skip this part. So it's King Joffrey's, I think it's his wedding day, or it's his birthday. One or the other. I think it's a wedding. So he's getting married to Marjorie Tyrell. And they're at this banquet after they've been married, whatever. Yay, we're having a bunch of entertainment happen. And there's a scene, and there's a part where Tyrion fills up the king's drink with wine and then gives it to the king. King drinks it. He starts choking to death. Now, did the perpetrators, the conspirators, did they know that was going to happen? Did they set him up to do that? Or did they just take advantage of a situation and then slip in some poison at the time? Not really clear. But they clearly know that Tyrion didn't do it, and they don't say anything because they know that they would be murdered if they did, or killed in response. I kind of lost my train of thought. I'm not exactly sure what my point is. She's, you know, as far as what happened, it looks kind of like, even though, I mean, if you're going to kill somebody, would you really be caught handing the murder weapon, you know, to the poisoned glass to the king? Are you really that stupid? So really, Cersei should know better. She should know that her brother didn't kill her son, but she's hated her brother her whole life. And in the past, he had kind of threatened her. For, you know, rightfully or not, I'm not exactly sure. We'd have to get into that. But their relationship is one of constant threats and retaliation throughout their whole lives. But her justification is, he threatened me in the past. He said that all my joys would turn to ashes in my mouth. This is his revenge against me for whatever I've done in the past to him. So in her mind, I think she believes to be right, because he did hand the glass over to him, to the poison glass to the king, and then he did disappear after he was found guilty. So to answer your question, after 10 minutes, that's what I'm saying.
I feel like this entire episode is all about these gray areas where we're not quite sure what we think. We're trying to apply the NAP, but there's certain degrees of things like that are moral and immoral, and this is a frustrating one for me.
Yeah. So is she justified in taking out a bounty on, you know, her brother, her runaway brother, dead or alive? It seems like it would be the more responsible thing to say alive, wouldn't you? But it, like you said, it's more difficult and dangerous to do that. So there's an incentive to bring him back dead.
Yeah, I mean, again, we don't know what Ancapistan is going to have for service providers for things like this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if there are DROs like Steph talks about, then you would take it to them, right?
Probably. There'd probably be some, there's a market need. There's going to be someone in there providing that service and multiple people doing that. There'd be competition. And the best way would win out, the most preferable way, most people.
Right, because in today's world, you would go to the police and, you know, they do their shit show job on it, ham-fisted. And then if they do find out who did it, then there's, you know, quote-unquote justice meted out to them if it goes, like, through trial and they get convicted. But how does that restore the victim in any way other than mm-hmm. the knowledge that someone's locked up?
Right. And sometimes that's all people care about. They just want it to not happen to any other people, not happen again. Just lock this person away. He's dangerous. He's going to go out and try and murder people as soon as he's let out or whatever. But most of the time, you know, like you say, what does that do for the person? It doesn't restore the dead person. Obviously, you can't do that. Does it restore the property that is destroyed? No.
Yeah, all I know is that without the legitimization of the initiation of force and a monopoly on services in that sector, that things would be better without that. That's all I know.
It's true. The market would better service the people than a monopoly does in all instances.
All right, so let's move on just a little bit. You wanted to talk about the KKK type guys. And I feel like
yeah,
we already sort of did, but...
Well, I have that question. Are they justified in shooting at the KKK guys who are destroying their property?
Well, they thought they were killing them.
Yeah.
So it was certainly...
But they weren't.
To harm them.
It was intended to harm them, but were they actually in danger of being harmed? No.
Well, I mean, what would you do if, in Ancapistan, if someone did a drive-by in your house intending to kill you? I mean, and you are the victim of a drive-by.
But I'm in the house across the street instead? I could see the intent there, but the imminent threat is not there, the imminent danger.
Yeah, well, I mean, I do think that Django and Waltz do go beyond.
It's like somebody with you know, with the threat and the intent to hurt somebody, but without the ability.
Yeah. No, I think probably shouldn't have shot Big Daddy. They should have just escaped into the night. I mean, Big Daddy's probably not going to find them if they, you know, move 5 miles further.
Right. You just leave the area, and I'm sure they're not going to come chasing after you.
Yeah, and it's not like there was a bounty on Big Daddy. I mean, it was a movie, and so for the, you know, dramatic effect and the story arc or whatever, they had to kill him. Yeah, that happened. But in real life, yeah, he wasn't. Because they weren't actually there, even though Big Daddy intended to kill them and raided them with a bunch of, you know, 35 other dudes who couldn't see out of their fucking sheets.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. They weren't in direct harm, and since Big Daddy didn't know where they were, he wasn't a threat to them.
Right. Now, I forget exactly how the scene goes. Do the KKK guys start taking fire when they're surrounding the wagon, or was it when they're leaving the wagon? Because I know they're just once they start getting shot at, I think they just kind of haul ass out of there. Is that right?
Well, Wentz, how do you say his name? Waltz.
Christoph Waltz, yeah.
He waits until they get down there, and they've already been, like, poking around and shooting around his little stagecoach with the tooth on the top.
Mm-hmm.
And his first shot is at the tooth because he's packed it with dynamite. The initial shot is these guys are all around there, and then there's this explosion.
Okay. And that's what sends them running?
Right, and then he shoots. Does he shoot a few of them on the way out, and then he hands the rifle to Django, and Django takes his time to get a fix on Daddy and shoots Big Daddy.
Right, right. Okay. So, yeah, I think they were not morally justified in doing that. If they had been in the wagon, then sure, shoot back, absolutely. But at the same time, you are dealing with violent thugs. But, yeah, like I said, there's no imminent threat. So.
Yeah, I mean, I keep thinking, like, what if, my house and office situation is such that I'm separate from the house a little bit. So let's say I saw somebody, like, do a drive-by on my house.
Mm-hmm.
And they're shooting up the house, and I'm out of my office. I mean, can I come out and, like, shoot back, even though they're not shooting my office?
Well, you have loved ones in that house, absolutely.
Well, I mean, right now they're gone, but yeah.
Yeah, right now they're gone. Man, that's up to you how you feel in the moment, I think. There's a chance that a stray bullet, you know, you're getting shot in that direction, although you're in your submarine tank. I think that steel could absorb a few bullets.
Yeah, it's 14 gauge, baby.
Yeah, I think. You need, like, a cannon shot to punch through that stuff. In my opinion, I think that you would not be justified if there was nobody in the house and you're clearly not in any harm. But, you know, that's up to you in the moment to decide whether or not you think you're in any kind of danger. And you're also coming to the defense of your property. I mean, you got to kind of let people know that you can't just get drive-by'd. I mean, you are in a pretty rough neighborhood.
I am.
True. True. You're in a pretty rough neighborhood.
Literally, I'm in a terrible neighborhood.
Yeah, you are. Not that I've heard of any drive-bys. I'm actually the only person that's been drive-by in this conversation. But funny that you think about these things. it's a good thing to think about.
All right, well, let's move on because I think we're getting stymied a little bit here.
Okay.
There's one thing I wanted to talk about, and that is about the Mandingo fighting and how they represent themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And in their initial negotiations with Candy, they say, how much for your best fighter? And Candy's like, no, I'm not going to give him up. Well, what about your second best fighter? Nope, not going to give him up either. And Walt says, well, I bet you'd give up your third best fighter for an exorbitant amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
And the lesson I saw there was that Candy is exhibiting a preference scale, a marginal utility of the property that he has.
Yeah.
He's saying that I've got, you know, all these fighters, and I'm not willing to part with my top guy, my next guy, and my third guy, you're going to need to overpay for him.
Yeah, it's a seller's market there. He's got a very rare thing, and the money doesn't mean a whole lot to him.
Right, and it's an Austrian economics thing. It's Karl Menger and marginal utility, where he's got, you know, a certain number of
slaves.
Slaves. In Menger, he talks about, I think, horses and cows and, I think, logs or something, you know, and if he's got five, he's going to satisfy five of his wants. But if one of them gets lost or destroyed, then he's only going to satisfy four of his wants, and they're going to be the top four on his preference scale. So, you know, whatever's the least important to him will not get fulfilled if he loses one. In contrast, if he were to gain an additional one, so he goes from five to six, then he can do something else that is even less important to him, but he still desires to do. And so that was what I got out of that little scene or that conversation, was that he's exhibiting a preference scale. And that's kind of a cool thing to see in a movie, to notice that.
Even though it is talking about human beings that he purports to own.
Yes. So if you were listening to this and you were a reporter for the New York Times, you would say that we were talking about selling humans and that it was great.
Man, I saw that Django Unchained movie. Man, it was great when he was talking about not wanting to sell that slave because he liked the slave so much.
Yeah, so
fantastic,
I'm just looking at
display
the
of preference. Marginal utility preference. Wonderful.
It's something
loved
being bought
it
and sold, and he has multiple of. You know, he's not going to sell his best one or his second best one. Oh, man, I do sound like a terrible person.
Usually. That's fine. That's what I'm here for. So
that leads right into your wanting to discuss that they represent themselves to Candy as somebody who is into Mandingo fighting and is willing to overpay a large sum of money in order to gain his confidence, get invited to his house, to be, you know, to gain an audience, to get in his presence, and all as a ruse to try to free Django's wife. And by free, they mean, like, purchase her and get the legal documents saying that she's free. So, I mean, they're still working within the status confines. But I was just going to say, the contrast is, if they went to Candy and just said, hey, we want to buy this German-speaking slave girl you have for $100, you wouldn't give him the time of day.
Right.
Like, that was
her. Had to have some sort of pretense to get in there to get his attention. Because, and part of the story was that, yeah, you're right, she spoke German and he was from Germany, and that was their whole excuse as to why he wanted to talk to her.
Right, which, you know, very convenient for the screenwriting.
Yeah,
German lead character and Django's wife happens to have been raised in a German household and speaks German. But,
right.
You know, whatever.
Whatever.
Story time.
So let's talk about what Mandingo fighting is, Daniel. In your words, what is Mandingo fighting?
Well, in the film, it's they take... It's like cockfighting, but with your slaves. So you take your strongest, most lethal fighter, and you pit him against someone else's most, you know, tough fighter, and you bet on them. And it's a fight to the death.
Yes, a fight to the death.
So cockfighting, but with humans, owned humans, so slaves.
Yeah, they have no choice. They have to fight, or else they'll get whipped and possibly murdered.
Well, and there's an example of that later on.
That's right, he does get murdered. Ripped apart by dogs.
Right.
But I think he's an escape. Is he an escape slave, or...
Well, he had fought two or three times and knew that he needed to fight five times and he couldn't do it, so he ran away.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Because he knew that he would die or something would, you know, it was something he chose to accept the consequences of trying to escape.
Right. So the question is, when you're dealing with Monsieur Candy, who is perfectly fine and, in fact, revels and enjoys watching other human beings under threat of death beat other human beings to death, and possibly wager money on it, are you under any kind of moral obligation to deal with him in a straightforward manner?
Well, they are misrepresenting themselves under false pretenses in order to gain his confidence.
So they're being immoral, you think, when they do that?
Well, yeah. I mean, morality is subjective. So they are. But it is an ends justifying the means situation. Not that the ends always justify the means, but in this particular instance, they do.
Okay, what I would say is that they are under no obligation to be moral in any way when you're dealing with a completely immoral person who is constantly threatening other people at all times.
Are you equating morality with obligation? Because the lie is moral or not in a vacuum, and obviously not. Obligation is morality an obligation? Because you're conflating them.
Well, so you're saying that you're never under any kind of obligation to act morally in any way? Just whether or not you choose to or not? Whether you can just, like, a feather in your cap to say that you're being moral or not? Like, as a means to an end, like, as a pragmatic decision?
Well, I think there's certainly an advantage to being moral in most instances, but, I mean, everyone tells white lies and on up.
So for you, is the act of
whatever they
behaving
chose is more desirable?
Okay. But is the act of being moral, behaving morally for you, strictly a pragmatic decision? The fact that you act morally, people will treat you morally in response, and you tend to be thought of as a better person and that sort of thing?
Well, I think that it's best to be moral in most situations.
Okay, well, the word best means you're putting a value on it, a pragmatic value on it.
Sure, and you're putting a hard value on it. You're saying you must be moral at all times. You're obligated to be. Unless someone is immoral initially, and then you can do whatever you want.
Well, if you want to follow the map or not.
On some level, all the time, or at some point has been immoral. Now, where's your line, Robert? Like, if you're going to say that the fact that Candy owns slaves, he's immoral, then why would anyone ever be truthful with him, ever?
Yeah. Because he's constantly aggressing against people at all times.
Right.
He's constantly threatening other human beings all the time.
Right. So if that's the case, then what does it mean to be obligated to be moral unless someone is constantly immoral or even sometimes immoral? And then you throw that out the window? So you're actually being pragmatic. you're saying that morality only applies when someone else is being moral. But since in this movie, and at that generation, at that time, in that culture, owning humans was, you know, viewed as permissible and okay, even though they didn't know any better, or some people did and some people didn't,
you're
saying that they're being immoral, and therefore you don't have to be moral to them in response. So at what good is morality, especially if you're claiming it's obligatory, when everyone is committing immoral acts? Then isn't that just a recipe for more and more?
I'm saying that there is a certain sort of pragmatism to morality. Sure, I think that a moral world would be a better world. That's my argument for the whole reason of behind morality. Yes, morality for morality's sake. I don't know if you want to call that a tautology or circular reasoning or whatever. I don't think it necessarily gets you anywhere.
This is the episode where we don't solve a fucking thing, and it's beautiful.
Yeah, this is just one giant car wreck of...
I can tear apart all of the ANCOM stuff, all the status stuff, all the mainstream media shit, and yet I get on the phone with you for 2 hours, and I'm like, I don't know, man.
So the moral argument against slavery, okay, because more people have self-ownership, and so Candy is violating the self-ownership of the slaves at all times by claiming ownership over them. And it would be better for the slave to be free than to be subjugated and quote-unquote owned by the slave owner.
That's actually a value judgment. I did see something that indicated that many slaves actually preferred slavery to being freed because of their lifetime in slavery. I think Shawshank Redemption, when Red is going to get out of prison.
Sure.
They don't know how to get by on their own. Like they have become reliant on the situation.
Well, which is represented by the Sam Jackson character in the movie. His life is actually pretty good. And so he defends Candy at all times. His livelihood is basically tied in to Monsieur Candy's.
Right, and then he tries to play the identity politics card at the end, and when Django's like, all right, you girls get out of here, because you know, they were slaves. He's like, no,
correct.
Get out of here. And Sam
Jackson
speak out too, and he's like, nope, not you, motherfucker.
because Sam Jackson, who I thought was hilarious in that movie, I don't know if you did, but I thought he was freaking hilarious. He was absolutely tied into Candy and supported him, and he actually is the one that figured out that Fox and Waltz were there for the girl, and that the whole thing was a big lie. Huh?
And turned him in.
Turned him in.
Like, told Candy about it.
Yeah. He figured it out, and he told Candy. He pulled Candy aside and told him about it, yeah. Like, coming into the kitchen.
When what's it off his nose if they buy this slave girl and she's gone? Like, who gives a shit? But whatever.
Right. What do they care, other than that they're being lied to? They can somehow take offense at that. When they're terrible people. But anyway. So.
You're saying that they didn't have any moral justification to not misrepresent themselves to Candy because Candy is a slave owner, as, you know, a bunch of people were at the time.
I think they were under no moral obligation to treat Candy straightly and squarely at any point, yes.
But they were being fraudulent in misrepresenting their intentions.
Other than, well, yeah.
But it's okay, so you're justifying the means.
Okay, if somebody kidnapped your wife, held him in their basement, and, you know, led him up to make him sandwiches and get raped and whatever.
I was with you until the get raped part.
Really?
I'm kind of okay with all the rest.
You're okay with the rest of it? You're like, why don't you go ahead and kidnap her? You're a terrible person.
I gotta cut this part out.
Yeah, you're gonna have to cut this part out. Okay, so
just kidding, honey. I love you.
So are you justified in using force to free her? Because I'll tell you that my main character in my book uses all kinds of force to rescue a kidnapped victim.
Well,
I think he's perfectly justified.
The main character in your book is based on me, of course. Of course.
Nice try. Based on me. Because apparently I'm the only moral one of us. Are you justified in using force to free? Because I tell you, it happens all the time in movies. Books.
Well, let's take it down from force, because they're not
SWAT
using
teams?
Force to gain the confidence of Candy, right? I mean, they could just storm in there and start shooting.
Right, but they'd be outnumbered. But that's what they end up doing in the end.
Right, and they win.
Right.
You know, so the question is really, did they do something fraudulent to gain the confidence? And yes, they did. Were they justified in doing so? Sure, the ends justified the means in this case.
Okay, so if they had just stormed the place and started, you know, they killed Candy and they killed the taskmasters or whatever you call the guys holding the whips, and they freed all the slaves, perfectly justifiable? Yes or no?
On a moral level, yes. Even though they don't know they're doing the crime, even though they don't realize that they're doing something that's immoral and evil.
Well, because government told them that it's legal.
Right, and they did. Like they believed that it was perfectly fine what they were doing, buying and selling.
Okay, so what if this person that kidnapped your wife? You're in a world where kidnapping is like normal.
Well, it is.
And nobody recognizes it.
We have the largest incarceration rate in the world right now.
So it's practically true.
Right.
So you wouldn't be justified in using force to gain her back, then, to free her.
I would not be? Why not? Why not?
Right? I think you are.
Yeah, I think I am too.
Okay.
That it probably wouldn't work out in your favor. You're vastly outnumbered and outgunned.
Okay. Very good. Excellent.
Right. Let's move on to one other point I wanted to bring up, because at the climactic scene in Candy's household.
Oh, wow. That's the exact thing now I was going to make up. I was going to bring up.
They
go ahead.
Draw up documents. I mean, this
yep.
is after it's discovered that you're not actually going to buy a Mandingo fighter. You're actually after this woman, and we want this exorbitant sum or something, right?
Right.
Something
they end up still selling them to him, but for a crazy price.
Yeah,
right.
For some crazy price. And they're willing to do it. And he actually had more money than that in his wallet, which is fine.
Right.
So why the ruse? You know, why not just say, hey, I'll give you $5,000 for it. You know, it's 100 times what you'll get for her.
Right.
Whatever. It doesn't make much of a movie if you just go and shoot or just come up with, hey, I'm going to give you $10,000 for her.
Right. You have to have some dramatic action going on.
But what do you think of the situation where the deal is done? It's
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Money has changed hands.
Yep.
All these things have already happened.
Yep.
And yet Candy later demands a handshake. And
he demands a handshake. Yep.
It's my house.
Right. In the South. He goes, in the South, it's customary that the deal isn't done until we've had a handshake, something like that.
Right. Even though in their legal world, no one's going to see the handshake. They're going to see the stamp, the signature, the waxed, you know, impression. They're
right.
going to see the document.
Right.
And that's done. That deal is done.
Right. So is he out of order demanding this handshake? And then is Walt out of order shooting him in response?
Yeah, so this is a tough one because there's a lot going on here. Number one, I think that...
Well, they already have guns on them.
They do.
Candy's already pointed guns at Walt and Django.
Right, but then they agree to sell her for $12,000.
Right.
And things seem to calm down a little bit. They're eating cake.
Kind of under threat, though. Isn't there an implied threat? Isn't there a gun on somebody in the room?
Like there's certainly guns Candy. In the room, and they say... When he demands the handshake and Walt says, no, I'm not going to shake your hand, then they point the gun at the girl and say, well, the deal's not done yet until you sign, and she's still my property. I can do whatever I want with her.
Yeah.
So then I'm going to, you know, if you don't shake my hand, I'm going to shoot her.
Right. So at that point, Walt seems perfectly justified in shooting him. To me. You're coming to the defense of another, even though the more probably logical, safer path would be to just shake the guy's hand and walk out of there.
Yeah, and I didn't quite get that. Like, is it that he's so disgusted with him that he won't do it, and DiCaprio is so insistent that he actually wants the handshake, or does it mean that DiCaprio was going to do some harm to Waltz? Like, I didn't quite get
I think the whole part was that Candy wanted to be the one who got the better end of the bargain, which he already was getting, but he really wanted to stick it to these two guys.
Okay, so it was a
what I got out of it. Yeah, I think so. I think it was because they kind of came in and were trying to get the better of him. By fooling him about what they really wanted. And he didn't want to get, like, quote-unquote, taken advantage of in that, like, this business deal. So he wanted to get the upper hand, and he really wanted to stick it to the guy at the end.
So you're saying that the handshake would have eliminated the threat?
Yeah. That was it seemed to be, even though I'll make the argument that these people are already violent thugs, and they've already established themselves as being untrustworthy by resorting to violence, you are establishing that you are not a trustworthy individual. Therefore, you are free to deal with violent thugs as you would, as any way you see fit.
But they're also there under false pretenses, so everyone's lying to everyone.
Right. And then there's also this kind of culture of, you know, a handshake seals a deal and whatever. I'll give Walt the benefit of the doubt, that character, the benefit of the doubt in that situation, although he was also kind of making the decision for Django as well. By shooting Candy, he ensures that there's nothing but a violent outcome.
Right. Right.
He's ensuring essentially his own death and possibly Django's own death and Django's wife's death also.
Right, yeah, because he has a two-shot Derringer pistol. He uses
right.
one of them. And that's the other thing. Like, why didn't he use the other on the other dude?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, the opportunity.
All I can say, yeah, it was in the script.
Yeah, it's in
yeah,
the script.
I know. It was in the script.
But yeah, I mean, he had a path to a less violent resolution, and he chose something else.
Right, and he chose it. If it was just him in the room, I would say, you know, you do what you want. But he's also making the decision for the other two people in the room that he cares about. And that is less...
He kind of seals their fate. I mean, he can't expect that Django's going to get out of that.
Yeah, I mean, Django becoming this insane gunslinger fighter guy, you know, they kind of got to establish that in order for this crazy finale to happen. Because, yeah, he is essentially... There's this massive gunfight where he... basically running away from all the hired hands and getting shot at, and he like hides in like a dresser drawer before he escapes and then comes back. Is that right? Is that how it happens?
Yeah, I mean, he's using like the dead bodies of some of the guys that were killed as human shields, and this one guy keeps getting shot and complaining about it. And then then Sam Jackson comes out and says, "I got your girl, and we're going to shoot her unless you come out and give up."
That's right. And then they capture him, and they're holding him upside down, and they're going to castrate him.
Right, and then the lady says, "No, we're going to sell him to these Australian miners."
That's right, played by Quentin Tarantino himself.
Right. Now, that is an interesting situation. So they sell him to those people. And
who it's understood that they're going to be working these slaves to death in this mine.
Right, and it's terrible.
Right.
But on the way, Django says, "Hey, there's a bounty on those dudes back there, and if you help me go back and get them, you'll get all the money, you know, $11,500. And they agree
right.
to it.
Right.
Then he shoots them.
Yeah, he murders them.
That didn't sit right with me. And I know you're going to say, well, they were slave owners and they were going to work them to death, you know, after 20 years of hard labor.
Yeah.
So he's sort of justified in a way. But he came to an agreement with them to go back there and, you know, take on the candy guys.
Right.
But he just ups and shoots them.
That
didn't sit right with me.
Okay, so why didn't it sit right with you? Because you thought that the bargain made under duress, under coercion, was a valid argument, a valid contract?
I don't think the agreement was under duress. They didn't force him to agree to it. He was offering them an option.
He's doing whatever he can to get out of being kidnapped. I don't think he's under any obligation, any kind of moral obligation, to treat them fairly in any way whatsoever. He is under coercion and threat the whole time.
It's almost as if you're saying that as long as you can get away with it, of shooting back and getting out of a situation where the government is...
He didn't initiate the force. Django didn't initiate any force.
But the reason you wouldn't do it today is because they'd get you. You know, even if you got away from this one. Like, if you were being brought in by the police and you came up with some bargain for them to, like, get some, you know, personal benefit, and they gave you a gun, and you shot them, you couldn't get away with it today. Because in today's world, they'd get you pretty quickly. I think 150 years ago, you know, once you shoot those three dudes, it's kind of like, well, who's going to really know? You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, who's really going to know? And then it's this movie, and also, you know, I mean, clearly, probably at the end of the day, there's probably a huge bounty on his head for all these murders. You know, he's a slave, and he killed a bunch of white people. And so he's going to be wanted for all these murders. And if there's a Django Part 2, maybe it's him fighting off against all these other bounty hunters. Who knows? Or marshals or cops or whatever. But yeah, today, you're a cop killer and or whatever, a murderer, even though you didn't initiate the force. You're acting defensively to not be kidnapped, to escape a kidnapping. You know, how much stock do you put in the saying, you know, the guy that starts the violence doesn't get to decide when the violence ends?
Or how it ends.
Or how it ends. You're violently attacking somebody by locking them in this cage, and you're going to take them to these mines. And then you're surprised when the guy shoots you and escapes?
Yeah, I guess it didn't sit well with me because one, he was making a bargain with them, and then two, he could have used three extra hands in taking on the Candy Mansion.
True. True, but then he wouldn't have been as much of a badass.
Yeah, and that's the other thing where they say, oh, you get to kill white people and get paid for it? That also
right.
did not sit well with me. That seemed like a nod to the SJW crowd.
Right. Even though this predates that. I mean, I guess it's been a while, several years that these SJWs have been roiling around, but this movie was made like 4 years ago.
Yeah, but it was clearly a line added in there to, you know, cater to the race baiting.
Yeah, it seems like it. I mean, just the idea that just because you happen to have white skin means that you are part of some sort of power class, and therefore you're a terrible person, and that you deserve to be murdered is horrific and ridiculous.
Yeah.
Obviously.
So, I don't know, man. Did we solve anything? I feel like we just muddled almost everything, all of our arguments, all of our principles, all of our claims at being adherence to the NAP. Though, you know, I will say, in a personal level, I do attempt to do that in my life, and I also attempt to not take, you know, advantage of programs that are offered to me that are provided by government and hence theft and coercion.
Even though some would argue, some would argue that you were just recouping lost funds.
Yes, some would argue that. And also I've heard the other side, well, you still drive on government roads, don't you? So you're still using it. I'm like, well, I don't have really an alternative, do I? Not a whole lot of options out there. And they got a monopoly on the motherfucker.
Yeah, yeah. The fact that we get taken to task for using monopoly services, it's like, yeah, we're terrible people. But you don't want to pay taxes, but you use all these monopoly services. You know, like, we have a choice. You're just stealing from society.
Let's wind this one down. My wife unit is home with kids, and so I'm going to need to get going here.
All right.
But do you think we solved anything? Is there any last things you wanted to say on the Django, on the Maximum Freedom Unchained?
Parting thoughts. Well, good movie. I think these are some of our best episodes where we take on these ambiguous and not very clear-cut stuff. We don't necessarily come up with big answers because there's not really big, clear, black-and-white answers in this world, especially when you're dealing with government and monopolies and the legal right to initiate force. Not the moral right, but the legal right, apparently. So, yeah, I think these are better when we're just kind of trying to figure it out, even though we don't necessarily come up with answers. Maybe that makes it sound stupid. I don't know.
Well,
at least we admit that we don't know.
I think these are tough questions, and I think that the blanket answer of, well, the free market will figure it out, though unsatisfying, is mostly true.
Well, yeah, because people that try and think that they know the future or can predict the future are always wrong. So the market is filled with 7 billion people that are a whole lot going to know a whole lot more about a whole lot more things than any one person is going to. And trying to figure out the best way that a market's going to work is always going to be wrong because it just happens organically.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in favor of not having a monopoly and not having basically a sanction to the initiation of violence. I think that the alternative to that, come what may, is better.
Yeah, and if you did have a DRO that, you know, for whatever reason, used rather extreme measures to fulfill contracts or, you know, wanted, you know, bounties or whatever, you know, maybe that service wouldn't get used as much as another service that found a better way or a more agreeable way or a more moral way to do things.
Yeah, maybe a constant evolving of improvement, you know.
Yeah, you'd be subject to market forces. People wouldn't use you and you'd have to figure out another way or another company would come in and do a better job and get the business.
Yeah,
whereas with government, we have this shit service called the police. We have them regardless of whether they do a good job or not. They're under no incentive to improve their service.
And whatever repercussions there are ineffective at best. I mean, there's internal affairs and there's some show court situations with police shootings, but they usually get absolved of it.
They get absolved, and usually when there is some any kind of issue, you're given, like, vacation.
Yeah, paid vacation.
Yeah, you just killed somebody. Take a month paid vacation off. Okay.
Yeah.
You really slapped me on. That's a good one.
Wait, so you're saying I get a few months off if I go and shoot people?
Yeah, how is that
what
the right
deal.
Incentive?
All right, man. Let's wrap this one up. So we've been the Reed Rothbard podcast. This has been Maximum Freedom Unchained. Hope we at least raised a few eyebrows and a few questions. We didn't have all the answers on this one, but at least we're having the conversation. I think that's an important part. And we hope it was at least a little bit entertaining. And if you do have any Amazon shopping to do, click on one of our motherfucking Amazon links on ReedRothbard.com. Smash those links, as they would say on Anarchy Ball, right? It says smash that like button.
Smash that button. Absolutely, guys. Thanks for listening. We'll have another episode for you next week. Don't know what it's going to be about. Maybe it'll be Joss Whedon. Maybe it'll be something else that happens in the news. Who knows? But this is good. I like this one.
All right, well, we'll see when it's when the sausage is done being made, if we still think it's any good, see if it tastes all right.
It'll be delicious. A nice winter sausage for Christmas.
And speaking of Christmas, I think we are going to do a Christmas special. It'll probably be Christmas Carol. We've started thinking about it, and there's lots of content in there, so that'll be a fun one.
Yeah, and there's a million adaptations of that. Everybody's familiar with it on some level. So if you watch Bill Murray's Scrooged, you've actually seen some animated version, a play. There's a million adaptations. So.
Yeah, prep now, so when you listen to our show, you'll be right along with us on the arguments.
Yeah, see if you can watch it and see if you have any moral qualms with anything that's happening on that show. Because I'll tell you, the popular opinion, in my view, is very wrong. But we'll get into it.
No controversial. Beautiful.
Yeah.
All right, folks. Well, we have been the Reed Rothbard Podcast, ReedRothbard.com, Books, Lectures, Podcast, The Enemy of the State Podcast, which is lectures by Marianne Rothbard, a bunch of other stuff. We got the tip jar. We got Amazon links. We got the Liberty Classroom, all those things. And as always, we do appreciate you, even if there's just a half dozen of you. It's the reason we keep going. So thank you very much, and have a good night.
Take care, everybody. The chipmunks. C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do-do. Do-do-do-do. Do-do. Do-do-do-do.